On Friday, I looked over at my wife after seeing this, you are the CEO of using snowstorms in your sermons, and I said to Jen, I was like, I don't know how Ashley knew that. I am actually using a snowstorm as an illustration, totally unrelated to the snowstorm on Friday. So this is, I don't know, Jim, your daughter is prescient or a hacker or what, but I don't know, both. But, I mean, I know some of your background, dude. You could have taught her a lot. In probably the worst kept secret of my pastoral ministry, it will come as very little surprise to most of you that I am not an American. I am a Canadian, born and raised, and in fact, I had never really given any serious consideration to living anywhere but Canada. But one relationship changed all of that, and shockingly enough, no, it was not my relationship with God, at least not at first. I did what every good college kid does, at least Bible college kid does, because this is just the thing you do when you go to Bible college. You get married. You find a nice girl and you settle down. It's just what you do. I did happen to meet an incredible woman who happened to be from New York. And when it became less of a deal breaker for her, see, it never bothered me, but I was worried that she would either turn tail and run at the fact that I was a pastor or going to be a pastor or the fact that I was Canadian and meant that one of us had to live in a country that wasn't our own. It was pretty well smooth sailing from there on out. But throughout the first years of our marriage, we lived in Canada. That was just kind of the no-brainer at the time. Jen had gone to school in Canada with me, and so already had some of the immigration status to be able to live there. She became a permanent resident of Canada in our first year of marriage, and we kind of just went from there. But over the years, the call of freedom and liberty grew louder and louder in my ears until my heart began to bleed red, white, and blue, and I could no longer resist the pull to move to the good old U.S. of A. At least that's the way I tell the story to Americans, because they love to hear that. Because in reality, everything in my heart did not want to come to America, because I like where I lived. I was comfortable and happy. And there were so many barriers that threw themselves up in my life that I was worried whether I would make it here at all or not. I don't know if you're familiar at all with how immigration works. Most of you are born and raised Americans, so you've never had to think about it. It is complicated. It is long, it is arduous, and nobody tells you anything. So, congratulations! If you make it through, you either had a good lawyer or you got lucky. I had both. I also had God on my side, so thank you. Also, it is your fault because I'm here. So, some of you aren't going to be super thrilled that God made that work. Some of you are absolutely loving it. But one of the things that you had to do is you had to go to your nearest American consulate to have an interview so that they could get a sense of the fact that you are who you say you are and that your marriage is legitimate, which is great fun. We've had that happen twice now. But to get there, we had to go to Montreal. Now, when you live in Plattsburgh, going to Montreal is a fun little weekend excursion. You can go and do a day trip in Montreal. But it was 500 miles away from where we used to live. And so in the middle of winter in 2011, December of 2011, Jennifer and I had our long-awaited final immigration interview in Montreal. It had taken 11 months to book this interview. I had to book it in September. So we rented a car because we were driving a less than ideal vehicle at the time, and I think it was a Hyundai Accent, little compact car with all-wheel drive, or all-season tires, not all-wheel drive. I don't think they make cars that small with all-wheel drive. And we began our trip to Montreal. And before I leave any on any road trip, I always check the my current location weather and the destination weather and see how it is. And Montreal was clear and Fredericton was clear. And so I thought this is going to be smooth sailing. About 2 hours into the trip, we just passed a place called Edmundston, New Brunswick. It started to snow. And I was like, okay, well, I mean, the visibility's still good. I can still see. The roads are still clear. It's fine. And it was a whiteout. We got to Rivière-du-Loup, which is just this side, just the Quebec side of the border between New Brunswick and Quebec. It is the most unilanguage city I've ever been in. That's including Quebec City, the capital of Quebec. They spoke no English. It is terrifying. You feel like you're in the middle of a foreign country. And we are driving in practically Friday-like conditions. And after about an hour, I am white-knuckling it. And Jen just says, Jordan, just pull off. We just reached Rivière-du-Loup. We still had about 4 hours of driving on a good day to go. And we pulled off, and my hands hurt because I was so stressed because, of course, I didn't get the supplemental insurance on the rental vehicle. So as is, I was already terrified that I was going to get in an accident. And, I mean, my car insurance would have covered it, but that's a pain in the butt. I didn't need any of that in my life. And so I remember stopping at a McDonald's and somehow ordering breakfast and sitting in the car in the middle of the snowstorm wondering what we were going to do. Because we were in a catch-22. I couldn't keep going because I knew that I was going to get in an accident or die trying to get to Montreal to go and live in a place that I, in my heart of hearts, didn't really want to live in, but knew God was calling me to. We had very little money of which to speak of, so we couldn't really afford to get a hotel that night. And even if we could, my interview was in Montreal at 9 a.m. the next morning, so I would have had to have gotten up at 3:30 or 4 o'clock to make sure we were able to drive there. So I couldn't stop, but I couldn't keep going. In my mind, I was at a standstill, and I was alone and scared in the middle of what felt like the most foreign country I had ever been in, even though it was still in my home and native land. And I was absolutely terrified. Storms can do that to you. I don't know if you've ever been caught out in a sudden squall, but it can feel overwhelming. It can even feel all-consuming. When you're in the middle of a storm, sometimes it feels like it's a matter of life and death. And you don't know what to do because you feel like if you keep going, something bad is going to happen, but you can't stop and you can't go back. So all of the options just feel bad when you're in the middle of a storm. Life gets stormy sometimes. And when storms rage, it can be hard to remember what it was like to live outside of the storm. When life deals you a hand that feels unfair, that is uncalled for, and that hurts. When life is at its hardest, the storm feels all-consuming. And in those moments, hope can feel hard to come by. Maybe you know what that's like. Maybe you're going through something like that right now. You see, the benefits of storms in the world around us, the benefit of the snowstorm we just had this week, was that it was two things, really. The first was that we were warned ahead of time. We knew this was coming. Everybody knew it was coming. Trust me, if you went in and tried to do any shopping on Wednesday, you knew something bad was coming. So we knew it was coming. We had the foresight to know. And we knew that the storm would be over. We knew that the storm would only last so long. I heard nobody suggest that the snow that we were receiving on Friday would never stop. And even though weather people are comically known for being inaccurate in their predictions, at very least, they're kind of right enough so that we can trust what they're saying. On Friday, we were talking, Jennifer and I were talking about just how much snow we'd gotten, about how ridiculous it felt to try to walk the dog in fresh 12 inches of snow. And we talked about even how hard it was going to be to clean up and how frustrating it was that we had to be in the middle of this. But there was never a time where we doubted and questioned whether the storm would end. But life doesn't give us forecasts. And sadly, when you're caught in the middle, when you are in the thick of the storm, when it rages and it feels like there's no escape, for a lot of us, it would appear that the only reasonable thing in our estimation is to give up. The challenge is too much. The relationships too broken, the pain too debilitating, the grief too much to bear. And we come to the end of ourselves and we say, I can't do it. And to add into all of this, when storms get bad in life, we tend to begin to ask existential questions like, where is God in all of this? The storms of life have a unique way of bringing us to our knees. Whether it's in defeat or in prayer, one way or the other, storms have a remarkable ability to drive us to our knees. And in many ways, these two will seem similar, but we'll discover that they are worlds apart. And as I've been going through this week and working on this message, believe me when I tell you, I actually said to Jennifer, I think it was Tuesday when this kind of clearly started coming into view. It wasn't a message that I was excited to preach, because God often will bring topics and scriptures and concepts to my mind that need to speak to me first. And some of you know, and I'm not going to make this about me, so I'm not going to spill any delicious tea for you today, but I will say that this has been a stormy week in an already challenging 2020. Some of you know some, others know more, but in a season where it feels like the struggle is severe, in seasons when you feel like you can't see a way out, you may be tempted to give up. You may feel like there is no other choice. And before we go any further, before we unpack any scripture, and before we're confronted, sadly or not so sadly, with our own pain, I want to tell you this. I want you to hear this. And if you get nothing else out of this, I want you to hear it. Even in the middle of our worst storms, there is still hope. This is not the end. Even in the middle of the worst storm imaginable, there can be hope. There's a story that's told in three of the four stories of Jesus' life that we call the Gospels, that unpack the works, the life, and the words of Jesus. And this story is told in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. But today, I'd like us to look at a story in Mark chapter 4. If you don't have a Bible, if you do have a Bible, it's about three quarters of the way through mine. It's easy to find in the Bible app. If you want some help, let me know. We can help you get a Bible app, especially the Bible app that we use to have our digital notes. It's obviously going to be on the screen to either side of me if you don't want to be distracted by your phone as well. In Mark chapter 4, it's early in Jesus' life and his ministry. He's been teaching and his popularity has been spreading and crowds are coming and clamoring to hear from Jesus, but there's still a lot of confusion about who he is and what he wants to do. And at this point, he's treated like a rabbi, a prominent teacher who are, in Jesus' day at least, in first century Israel, they were considered highly regarded and highly respected. And so Jesus is really, in many ways, living a life of a rabbi. So he calls people to follow him, to learn from him, and to become like him. They're called his disciples. And like students, they learn to know what he knew. But like apprentices, they did that for the not just the sake of knowledge, but to do what Jesus did. And so in Mark chapter 4, Jesus had spent the day along the lake shore preaching and telling stories of the kingdom of God. And then in Mark 4, verse 35, we pick up the story that we're going to focus on this morning. Mark writes this. He says, "As evening came, Jesus said to his disciples, 'Let's cross to the other side of the lake.' So they took Jesus in the boat and started out, leaving the crowds behind, although other boats followed. But soon a fierce storm came up. High waves were breaking into the boat, and it began to fill with water." Now, for somebody like me, a disturbance like this makes me incredibly uncomfortable. I am not a sea-dwelling, seafaring person. When I go on the ferry to Vermont and it gets a little bit windy, I am a lot bit uncomfortable. So if you and I go out in a boat, or as us Canadians say, out in a boat, not out in a boot. If you say out in a boot, you're wrong. It's out in a boat. But if we go out and about, see, I'm Americanized, guys, and it begins to storm, I'm a head out. That is just my mentality. I have no ability. I have almost zero survival skills, y'all. Like, if we get into a post-apocalyptic world, I'm going to be like the traveling bard because I can play my guitar just enough to entertain people. I have no serviceable abilities whatsoever in a post-apocalyptic world. And so when Jesus goes out with his disciples, you'll actually find that many of his disciples were fishermen, were people experienced in the sea. In fact, the Sea of Galilee was likely the place where he was teaching and where they were. And the Sea of Galilee was where four of his disciples were fishermen in. And that sea was actually known, the way of the makeup of that region often allowed for storms and squalls to almost instantly rise up. And so there would just be this formation that would come in with wind and waves, and it would just be terrible. And then suddenly it would just dissipate. And so in this place, these men would have been familiar with storms. But the story says that even though they were experienced fishermen, things started to go sideways somehow. In verse 38, Mark says, "Jesus was sleeping at the back of the boat with his head on a cushion, and the disciples woke him up shouting, 'Teacher, don't you care that we are going to drown?'" There's a striking contrast between Jesus' peaceful slumber and the disciples' panic. And the contrast is not lost on the disciples. In fact, the disciples didn't interpret Jesus, his untroubled sleep, as evidence that he trusted that they would get through this. Or confidence that the storm would pass, or even trust that God would protect them in the storm. They regarded it as a token of Jesus' indifference and their greatest hour of need. So they desperately awaken their rabbi and almost accusatorily demand, "Don't you care that we're going to drown. And as I read this story and as I read these words, I feel as though the author is inviting us to step into their shoes. And because though we have a fuller picture of who Jesus was and who what he came to do and what his word says compared to these men who only knew a little bit, I find myself realizing that I am not all that different from the followers of Jesus. Because often when things hit us, when life goes sideways, when things get hard, especially when you don't know how to get out of it, I am so quick to lose hope. And I am so likely to call out to my God and say, "Don't you even care?" Sometimes life hits you like a squall on the Sea of Galilee. Sometimes it hits you suddenly out of nowhere, blowing up and shaking you to your core. Other times you see it coming. You see clouds forming on the horizon, moving slowly towards you. You hear thunder in the distance. You recognize the lightning. Gradually, the darkness envelops you. But regardless of whether it's sudden or slow moving, storms have a way of pushing us to the brink. And when you're in the thick of it, even some of the most optimistic people crack. When the pressure is on, when we face tragic circumstances that we never asked for, that we never caused, and that we don't deserve, and when the storms are swirling, it's easy to find ourselves in full panic mode. It's easy to assume that you are at the end of the line. It's easy to see the storm as all-consuming. It's easy to assume that your story is over. And it's in moments like these that we point the finger at God, perhaps not explicitly, or maybe not even meaning to, but we tend to point the finger at God and we shout, "Don't you even care? Where are you?" Like the disciples in that boat, we sit back and wonder how Jesus can lay there and do nothing. We wonder if he even cares, if he's even listening. And once that comes into your mind, it becomes contagious in your thought process. When you suspect that God doesn't care, it becomes corrosive. And it eats away at you. It eats away at your joy. It eats away at your peace. It eats away at your faith in God. And it's easy to feel like I felt in that snowstorm so many years ago. It's easy to feel alone. It's easy to not just feel alone because you feel distant from God, even though you certainly feel distant from God, but it's easy to feel isolated from the people around you because you assume that you are the only one that goes through this. And you feel like you're in a French-speaking city, and you're the only English guy around. Because everything feels foreign, and you feel alone. What's interesting, though, is if you spend time reading the scriptures, this has been the story of God's people again and again. In times of darkness and pain, the people of God, called Israel, often cried out, wondering where God was, wondering if he still cared. And there's that assumption, I mentioned it earlier during prayer, there's that assumption in churches that it's the same way now. And it's the assumption that we have to come to God pretending like we have it figured out. And if you don't have it figured out, you better pretend you do. And I'm not sure where this misconception came from, but it's perpetuated in churches every week. But the good news is that this book, these stories, don't paint a picture of a people that have it figured out. In fact, if you spend some time reading through the Hebrew scriptures that we call our Old Testament, you'll find more often than not a people who are afraid and who feel alone and wonder why God abandoned them. But there's a peace that they begin to realize that we often forget. That even though they declare things like in Isaiah 49, God is speaking through one of his messengers about hope and redemption. And this is God speaking. He says, "Sing for joy, O heavens. Rejoice, O earth. Burst into song, O mountains. For the Lord has comforted his people and will have compassion on them in their suffering." Yet Jerusalem says, "The Lord has deserted us. The Lord has forgotten about us." David, one of the most prolific poets in the scriptures, as well as a king chosen by God, in a season where he felt alone and abandoned, in Psalm 13, says, "O Lord, how long will you forget me? Forever? How long will you look the other way? How long must I struggle with anguish in my soul, with sorrow in my heart every day? How long will my enemy have the upper hand?" Even Paul, who is the most prolific author in the New Testament, in 2 Corinthians 1, talks of his troubles in Asia. And he says, "We were under great pressure, far beyond our ability to endure, so that we despaired of life itself. Indeed, we felt as we had received the sentence of death." Each of these people, in fact, countless others, have declared the fear that God had left them. And by all accounts, looking around them, you may not have been wrong to tell them that they were right. If it was based solely on circumstances, you would be forgiven for feeling as though God had left. But God had a message for his people. And God still has a message for us. Through Isaiah, back in Isaiah 49, verses 15 and 16, God responds to the statement of Jerusalem that says, "God has forgotten us. God has abandoned us." And he says, "Can a mother forget her nursing child? Can she feel no love for the child she has born?" And he even says, "Even if it were possible, I would not forget you. See, I have written your name on the palms of my hand." And Paul, when he's talking about his struggles in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 8 and 9, he says, "We were pressed on every side by troubles, but we are not crushed. We are perplexed, but not driven to despair. We are hunted down, but never abandoned by God." In the middle of the storm, despair can threaten to steal your soul, to steal your joy, to steal your hope. And one thing that I found throughout all of these stories of these people of God who cry out, that they have to make a choice. They have to choose whether to trust that God was there. God would respond as he had, saying, "I have never left you. How could I forget you? I have written your name on the palms of my hand." As Paul would say, we have never been abandoned by God. So the narrative is in front of us. Do we trust what we can see, the storm around us, or do we trust in the presence of Jesus? Because what I have found, the more that I read these scriptures, in Psalm 13, I didn't even plan to share this, but in Psalm 13 that we shared where David is crying out, And he goes on to say in verse 3, he says, then turn and answer me, Lord. Boy, that's a bold thing to say. Restore the sparkle to my eye or I will die. Don't let my enemies gloat, saying we have defeated him. Don't let them rejoice at my downfall. But, and you'll find these poems, these songs always have a but. But I trust in your unfailing love. I will rejoice because you have rescued me. I will sing to the Lord because he is good to me. You see, David had to learn, even in the middle of the storm, even when at that time, and David was faced with significant opposition from people seeking to kill him. Paul, the same. David had to learn to trust that though nothing had changed, it was the same poem. Nothing had changed in David's life, but still he trusted, saying, I will trust in your unfailing love and I will rejoice for you have rescued me. Paul, despite being in an unwinnable position, proclaimed that God never left him either. He says, but as a result, we stopped relying on ourselves and learned to rely only on God who raises the dead. And he did rescue us from mortal danger. And this is the key. And he will rescue us again. Even though it felt like everything was crashing down around him, he trusts that God will deliver again. And it's something that Jesus reinforces to his disciples. It's something they learned through adversity. Jesus was on the boat with those followers the whole time. And his silence was not a statement of his lack of care. His refusal to panic did not mean he was ambivalent. Jesus was there. Jesus loved them. Jesus cares. And so in their panic, when they cry to him and they say, Lord, don't you care that we're going to drown? Mark says, when Jesus woke up, he rebuked the wind and said to the waves, silence, be still. And I'll say this, I wonder if he was saying that to his disciples as well. Silence, be still, because suddenly the wind stopped and there was a great calm. And then he asked them, why are you afraid? Do you still have no faith? You see, I don't think it was accidental that Jesus was asleep in the boat that night. I don't think that it was a coincidence that on the night that perhaps the most significant storm of his disciples' lives was brewing, that Jesus was quietly and unassumingly sleeping. You see, I think there was something greater going on, something that the disciples didn't understand. Maybe they couldn't understand it. And I think it's something that we need to hear. You may be struggling through a storm. You may be wondering where God is and what he is doing. But remember this, Jesus has never left you. He has never forsaken you. And he's not going to start now. Earlier this week, I shared a passage from the aptly named book, Lamentations. It was written as a series of laments, and a lament is a desperate, visceral cry of pain and of sorrow. And it was written following the destruction of Jerusalem. And at the center of this story is the destruction of their lives because they had forsaken God. But they will find that even though they had forsaken God, he had never forsaken them. Though their sins had led to their destruction, though everything felt dark and desolate, and though all ration and reason would tell the people of Israel to give up hope, the author of the poem in Lamentations 3 cannot relinquish hope. He writes this in Lamentations 3, starting in verse 17. He said, "Peace has been stripped away, and I have forgotten what prosperity is. I cry out, my splendor is gone. Everything I had hoped for from the Lord is lost. The thought of my suffering and homelessness is bitter beyond words. I will never forget this awful time as I grieve over my loss. And yet, I still dare to hope when I remember this. The faithful love of the Lord never ends. His mercies never cease. Great is his faithfulness. His mercies begin afresh every morning." Despite all evidence to the contrary, the author dares to hope. Things were desolate. Nothing was the way that it should have been. But even then, in his darkest day, in his worst hour, he dared to hope. He dared to believe that God was still there, that God's faithful love was still never ending, that his mercy still never ceased, that his faithfulness was still great. The author chose to rise up a song even in the middle of the worst storm. Believing like Paul that God had delivered them before and that he would deliver them again. And that's the beauty of the miracle of the storm that we read this morning. Jesus wasn't proclaiming, though some struggle to believe this, wasn't claiming that he would stand up and make storms to cease. He wasn't promising us that all of our troubles in life would magically disappear. The purpose of this story is to show that even in the worst of storms, even when life seems dark, even when you don't know what to do, Jesus is with you. And I know that we often want our Savior to deliver us from the storm, but what we are given is a Savior who will deliver us through it. And as you walk through the storms, as they rage against you, we have hope because Jesus is with us. And because Jesus is with us, our story isn't over. I know that it feels like this storm will never go away. I know that it feels like this pain will last forever. But God has promised that sorrow only lasts for a time. The clouds may try to cover the sun, but the sun always prevails. So while he walks with us, he promises that he will deliver us because of who Jesus is and what he has done, because of what he has promised. He knows how our story will end. And he has promised that he walks with us and that he will again deliver us. We know that in the end, he has already won. We know that he is trustworthy. We know that he is good and that he is loving. So when the storms of life threaten to drive you to your knees in defeat, don't let it win. Overcome by going to God in prayer and by singing strongly to him. This morning you may be here and you may be in the middle of the fight of your life. You may be struggling in ways you never thought were possible and that I'd never understand. Maybe you're looking for something that looks an awful lot like hope. Remember the words of Paul in his first letter to the Corinthians when he says, "For our troubles are small and won't last very long. They will produce for us a glory that vastly outweighs them and will last forever. So we don't look at our troubles we can see. Rather, we fix our gaze on things that cannot be seen. For the things we see now will soon be gone, but the things we cannot see last forever." And keep in mind, Paul is not being hyperbolic here. And he is not minimizing his own experiences. Understand that he had experienced suffering, magnitudes of which I could not understand. But he promises, even as he is being hunted down, even as he is being beaten, even as he is being imprisoned, he says, compared to the glory that God has promised to us, these sufferings are small and will only last a short time. The storms may rage and they may threaten, but remember what we read earlier. He has delivered us from such a deadly peril, and he will deliver us again. On him we have set our hope that he will continue to deliver us. When the storms threaten to overwhelm you, remember that Jesus is with you and he will see you through. Don't allow your storm to consume you. Choose to see God in the middle of the storm. Yet I still dare to hope. When I remember this, the faithful love of the Lord never ends. His mercy never ceases. Great is his faithfulness. His mercies begin afresh every morning. I'm going to ask if Sarah could come up at this time. We're going to close a bit differently this morning. One of the things I've been saying today is, oh yeah, Nick's coming too. One of the things that I think we do poorly in church is to give space to mourn. That book that we read from earlier called Lamentations is something we do really poorly. We assume that the only way to sing to God is to sing songs that sound awfully peppy and happy and joyful. And there's something to that. Even the stories and the poems that we shared this morning have a hopeful tone, but we've so often convinced ourselves that the only way we can sing is by singing happy, happy joy. And so I want to invite you to do something that is going to feel uncomfortable. It's going to feel uncommon. And for some of you, it's going to be a deal breaker. And I've just come to realize that sometimes you have to offer people things that they don't want. It's just part of life. There's a song that I've listened to a lot this week.